from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, in his new book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, the creator of the Dilbert comic strip shares his secret to success, failure. Scott Adams joins us to tell the story of how he flopped as a restaurant owner, investor, and office worker before becoming a successful cartoonist. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Bay Area-based cartoonist and author Scott Adams, who created the Dilbert cartoon, recently published a book called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. He joins us in studio for this Forum hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you talk about wanting to be a cartoonist way back when. You were about 6 years old and inspired by Peanuts. It took you a long time to get to that through a number of failures and everything. Maybe it was just a kind of process of finding out where your real talents lie.
Yeah, maybe it's like the sculptor who's trying to figure out how to get the elephant out of that big chunk of marble. You know, you just get rid of all the things that don't belong and you've got an elephant.
Yeah, or I was thinking about a line from the playwright Edward Albee. Sometimes you have to go a long way out of the way to get a short place ahead.
Yeah.
It's sort of, in some ways, your story, but it's a complicated story by the fact that, you know, you did fail. Velcro rosin bags and having a job as a gopher offered to you, doing a lot of stock in Web Van, all kinds of things here that I mentioned also in the Billboard. And these are just ways of kind of trial and error learning in many respects, aren't they?
Well, luckily, I took a more scientific approach to a lot of my failures, not the earliest ones. But eventually, I realized that if I chose my challenges correctly, the worst thing that could happen is I'd get to the other end of it with a new skill, a new set of connections, new, you know, people who might be useful in the future. So I, as an adult, I always chose things that I knew I would learn something or get something out of it, no matter whether the stated goal happened or not.
You learn from your mistakes, my father used to say, and that's really what you're saying here, or you learn from your failures. You can, in fact, as a result of failure, find your way eventually to success.
I'm actually taking another level beyond that. So I think people have always said, oh, you learn from failure, failure makes you stronger. But usually they're thinking along the lines of, you know, that toughened your skin. You know, now you know how hard you've got to be in the
world. I wasn't suggesting. I was suggesting more failure is a tool, and that's what you're saying.
Well, yeah. So just to expand on that a little bit, I made sure that the process of the failure, I was learning something, specific skills. For example, learning how to manage a restaurant is, you know, dealing with people. When I tried to make video games, I was learning a lot about technology. And all those things had a transfer forward value to me. They all made me more valuable as a citizen of Earth.
I also got the sense from reading your book that you believe in a kind of notion that people have to find their own way to success, that all these people who are telling you follow your passion and giving you these kind of aphorisms that supposedly are the method of finding success don't necessarily work in the way – well, you have a whole – brief against the idea of passion. We'll get into that. But don't necessarily listen to other people. They don't have the way.
There's a problem with advice in general. It works in narrow fields, maybe legal advice, maybe medical advice most of the time. But if you're giving somebody career advice, there simply are no two people who are alike. There are no two situations alike. Time marches forward. The environment's changing. So you're kind of running and shooting at a target that's also running. So you know, your best bet is to make yourself as valuable as possible. This is what I promote, to simply try to move yourself gradually from a place where the odds aren't good to a place where the odds are better.
You're also, how much of a believer in affirmations? That keeps coming into your narrative.
Yeah, I don't like to say I'm a believer because that kind of makes it sound like magic and, you know, there's something occult happening there. What you're talking about is the practice of repeating to yourself or writing down several times a day an objective, you know, what you would like to have happen.
I'm going to be a great syndicated columnist or widely read over and over like a mantra.
Right. And this is a method I've used since my early 20s. And I found that probably by coincidence, maybe by selective memory, maybe there's something else about the focus I put into it. But whatever the reasons, and they're still a mystery to me, the results seemed on the surface miraculous. That is to say, the odds of some of the things happening seemed really low before I started. And so I built kind of a pattern over time that when I really focused on something and really, really, really wanted it, the universe seemed to deliver it in ways that surprised me. But again, I don't believe in magic. I think there's probably...
Do you believe in universe deliveries? FedEx, or how do they deliver?
I barely believe in FedEx. I'm pretty skeptical. But no, I think there's something about putting your focus on something. I just don't know the mechanism involved.
Well, you believe in systems rather than goals.
I do. Specifically, a goal would be kind of a pinpoint, this is the one thing that I want. I want this thing. Let's say I want my boss's job. The problem with a goal is that it's too narrow because there might be a whole bunch of things in the universe that are better than your boss's job, and they might be available to you too if you don't put blinders on and focus on that one little area. So instead, I recommend systems where you're slowly building up your personal value and making yourself available for a lot of different opportunities.
We're talking with Scott Adams, who is the creator of Dilbert and also the author of a book called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. And talk a little bit about the story of your life. You define happiness, of course, defined by Freud as love and work. You define it in a different way. Happiness is health plus freedom. That's the equation for Scott Adams.
So the one thing I can bring to this discussion or any discussion is simplification. So as a cartoonist, that's the thing I do better than anything. And when you're trying to talk about success, everybody's got a different idea what that is, but everybody has the same notion that happiness is at the base of it all. So I thought before I could talk about any of this stuff, I need to define it in the simplest way to make it useful. So my simple definition of happiness is that it's just an equation of health plus freedom. Now, the health part is obvious. You need to be healthy to enjoy your life. But the freedom part goes beyond just political freedom. It's specifically the ability to do what you want to do at the time you want to do it. That's the kind of freedom I'm talking about. So, for example, if I said to you, Michael, here's your favorite food. Now, if I gave it to you right after you'd just eaten a huge Thanksgiving meal, your favorite food would be worthless to you. But if you were starving and I gave you a crusty old ham sandwich 4 days old, it would be the best thing you ever put in your mouth. So, and likewise, if you can nap when you're tired, eat when you're hungry, work when you feel energetic, do creative things when you feel creative, the quality of your life goes through the roof. And I discovered that because I do have a flexible schedule. Now, obviously, we can't all have flexible schedules, and I didn't have one for the first half of my life. But as a goal to work toward, you know, as an objective, you should always be looking at all your future options in that light. Like, will this allow me to have the flexibility to do the things I want to do when I want to do them? Oh, and by the way, you need some money. So, you know, don't forget the fact that you need to make some money to have any options in life. But think about timing as the lever that's the easiest to move. It's the most accessible part of happiness, I find.
Well, when we speak about health, let's talk about something that you went through, spasmodic dysphonia, which is a real problem with speaking. Diane Rehm, who many public radio listeners are familiar with, has it, and Bobby Kennedy Jr., has it. I think also the guy from Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels. This has been, you know, certainly an obstacle to freedom and difficulty. You couldn't speak for a while. He had very serious difficulty speaking and decided, for example, I know Diane Rehm was taking Botox and a lot of people who have it. You weren't going to take Botox. You were going to fight it in other ways.
Well, I tried the Botox, and what they do is they stick a small needle into the front of your neck by your Adam's apple just to deaden the pain enough so they can shove a bigger needle through the same, you know, similar hole. And then they give you a shot internal to your neck, to your vocal cords, by kind of guessing where they are. So there's a little bit of science, a little bit of guessing, a little bit of luck. So if you don't get the dose just right, it doesn't work as well as you'd want. Plus, it's always ramping up. You know, the dose doesn't start at its height. It ramps up, and then it starts wearing off. So there is an exact right amount that works for everybody. But finding that right amount and getting it in the right spot once a month is kind of a trick. Now, the people that it works for probably have either an architecture of their throat that makes that work, or they've got doctors that are really good at working with those patients. So the Botox can work. But for me, I tried it and it just didn't.
I got a quote from you. I'm going to cure it for everybody. Wipe it off the face of the earth.
Yeah, I get like that sometimes. Sometimes I'm not happy just solving a problem. If the problem makes me mad enough, and believe me, when you can't speak for 3.5 years, you get plenty mad. I thought, if I can beat this thing, I'm not going to just beat it for myself. You know, I think there are 30,000 people out there, many of whom don't know that there's any kind of a treatment or a cure. In fact, the early diagnosis for this, in my case, and historically this was often the case, is that it's a mental problem.
But it's pretty much believed not to be neurological for the most part, isn't it?
Well, it's believed to originate in your brain, specific part of the brain. But my surgeon, who was a genius who came up with this this particular treatment, he had this hypothesis that he could reroute the nerves in sort of the close to the surface of my neck on the outside without even penetrating where the vocal cords are and without ever touching my brain, the two parts that everybody thinks are the problem. So he cut the vocal cords between my brain and my vocal cords. Cut the nerves between brain and vocal cords. And he just said, wait 3.5 months, and when the new pathway regenerates, you'll either be able to talk or you won't. And I could. So
this started with something else before that, though. I mean, you had another dystonia affliction, yeah?
Yeah, it's the type of problem that sometimes happens in pairs. It doesn't usually progress beyond two, and it doesn't usually happen in two, but it's not uncommon. So I had a problem with my drawing hand before the voice. So several years before, just from overuse, and my pinky would spasm, but only in that very specific action where my pen touched the paper. Anything else, my hand was fine. It was completely functional for every other purpose. But when as soon as the pen touched paper, the pinky would spasm. And that, too, was a brain issue. It's not had nothing to do with the architecture of my hand. It wasn't carpal tunnel. It wasn't anything like that. And the way you can tell it's in the brain is that when I tried to draw left-handed, when my left hand would touch pen to paper, my right pinky would spasm. Hmm. That's how you know it's in the brain. So that, too, was incurable. The first time I got a temporary fix to it just by practicing for hours and hours, just touching a pen to paper and then pulling it away before the pinky spasmed. Until eventually I could keep it there for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and then suddenly it just reprogrammed, and it worked. So I think I'm the first person who ever got over a focal dystonia. But a few years later, I overused it again. It came back, and then I found a more permanent solution through a product called the Wacom. It's the company that makes computer monitors now, as well as drawing tablets. And they've got a device that I can draw on the screen. And here's the weird thing. Even though the stylus feels just like a pen, and I'm drawing directly to the screen, exactly like I would on a piece of paper, my brain doesn't feel it the same way it feels paper. So that tiny, tiny difference, and my hypothesis was that this would be exactly the case, that that would be enough of a difference that this spasmodic dystonia doesn't trigger, or the focal dystonia doesn't trigger.
So maybe there's, you said failure doesn't make you stronger, but these afflictions might make you stronger or more resourceful in terms of how to combat them.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, by moving to drawing on the computer, I cut my production time in half. I probably improved the quality of the drawings by 100%. And everything about my job got easier.
talking again with Scott Adams. You were talking before about feeling rage and expressing yourself, and when your father was dying, and you know, this is something that so many of us have gone through. Because I had the feeling when my dad was dying and suffering, I thought, you know, we could euthanate our animals, but we can't do that with our parents whom we love, and the cost, and you get into all those questions. You said some pretty strong things, though. I got into Deborah Saunders, the columnist writing about it, in fact, in the San Francisco Chronicle, and she said, you know, she sympathized with your grieving over your father, but you debased the debate because you're a public figure. And I guess what you debased was the fact saying anybody who would support legislation that said that this sort of thing ought to be outlawed, that is helping a patient die, you would like to have a long suffering death. I mean, it came out of that kind of rage, and certainly many can understand it. But in retrospect, was it perhaps intemperate of you to say such rather excessive things?
Well, if you look at the exact words of that blog post, I said in there, I probably will feel different in a month, but here's my honest feeling. My feeling is that if you have voted in a way, or you're an activist on the side of making doctor-assisted suicide illegal or keeping it illegal, that you're an accomplice in the torture of my parents, literally. Not figuratively. You're literally one of the people.
You indicted the state as an accomplice, too, because they allow for these laws.
Right. So I'm kind of done with the government for that. But what exactly is the right emotional response to your parents being tortured at the moment? I mean, this wasn't hypothetical. My father was suffering at that moment. So what is the right emotional response to that? So part of the debate requires information, right? Everybody's better if they have more information. So I thought that the people who were on that side of the debate, and it turns out that's a very small number, which is another thing I'd like to talk about here. But the people on that side of the debate, there are not very many of them, and they need to know that people like me, and there are a lot of me, at least half of the country, look at them the same way I would look at a pedophile, a terrorist, or any frickin' murderer. Like, I see them, I want them dead. Because I think they make the world a much worse place.
But you even say in the blog, there are those people, for example, who want to protect the fact that somebody's trying to get granny's money. I mean, you recognize that. And also, tougher moral questions about many people say, I mean, it works in the Netherlands, but would it work similarly here? And would it work on the large scale here? I mean, you've got some big questions.
So the question about whether it would work or whether there will be unforeseen problems have largely been answered because it's legal in enough places. There are a few states where it's legal, and there are a few countries where it's been legal for a while. As far as I know, none of them are looking to change the law. They all seem pretty happy about it. Nothing's, you know, spiraled out of control. So I put the question to my blog readers this way. I said, is there anybody who would say yes to this question, that if their doctor, themselves, and their family have decided on an end-of-life course of medical treatment, should the government have a veto over their decision? I got exactly zero people who were willing to say yes to that. But yet the polls, who apparently are worded with some fashion of, do you think doctors should be allowed to kill you as well as cure you? Well, of course half the country says no to that, the way you word it. But if you say you, your family, and your doctor have agreed on a course of action that is best for you. And by the way, and this has nothing to do with the decision, but by the way, it's way cheaper for you. It's way cheaper for the country. It's way better for your heirs. It's better for everybody. Do you think the government should have a veto on that? Nobody's going to say yes to that question. So I had a huge debate with basically two people that I know of, two creationists who had a problem with it. And I literally can't find one person who will take the other side of the debate.
That's a different argument, though, than I want people to suffer, which sounds to many people's minds like inhumane. You may have a reasonable disagreement with somebody about a moral issue or a policy, but yet to want them to suffer and to want them to die through suffering is... In fact, let me get another quote from that, get an explanation from you. I know there's no apology here for intemperance. You've made that utterly clear. But here's another quote that I want to get a response to from you. Women are treated differently by society. This is another statement of yours.
Oh, you're going to take this out of context, aren't you?
Well, you're going to tell me the context then. I just saw it out of context, so explain. It's your opportunity to do that. Women are treated differently by society for the same reason children and the mentally handicapped are treated differently. What did you mean?
Well, what's the rest of the sentence?
That's a quote that's on Wikipedia. I didn't see the rest of the sentence.
Taken out of context, it sounds pretty bad, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. If you put it in context, almost a few sentences later it says, I want to be very clear, I'm not comparing these groups. All right, so that's the context.
But they're treated by society the same way, meaning what specifically?
Well, I didn't say treated by society the same way.
For the same reason.
I said that men pick their fights based on who they're fighting with. So that was the context. And it was within the context of making fun of men. So that the larger post was making fun of men and men's rights or the thought that men were somehow mistreated by society. So I was mocking that. But I did say within the context of that, that a man will pick a fight with another man just for sport. Because man to man, we don't really take stuff personally. We say, all right, you disagree, let's fight it out. And you walk away and you're fine. But you don't pick a fight in the specific example I used in the post, which is also left out of the context, is that if you pick a fight with a woman over equal pay, you very quickly get to an emotional place before you get to the, can you compare my data with your data? All right. So that was just my point, is that there's some topics which you wouldn't use the N-word in an African-American community. There are lots of things that would be very sensitive to particular groups of people.
These emotional issues, and your book is emotional as well. I mean, and things you write in your blog, the example we just spoke about, how much do they play a role in your cartoon work, or do they?
Well, I keep the cartoon non-political because...
I didn't say political. I meant emotional.
Well, it's a different kind of emotion. People feel the emotion of being trapped by their, you know, pointy-haired boss. They feel the emotion of... where's my career going? I'm sitting in a little box. They feel the emotion of the frustration of their coworkers. So it's just different emotions. All entertainment has to touch emotion or else it's useless.
Let me get back to your book, because you mentioned luck in your book. And luck is a big factor in success, isn't it?
Luck might be the only important factor. But there is a lot you can do to manage your chances. So you can't directly affect luck, but you can move from a game that has bad odds to a game that has good odds. So, for example, the very first thing I did after graduating college is I traded my old broken-down car for a one-way ticket to California because my small town where I grew up had 2,000 residents. My graduating class was 40 people, same 40 people I went to kindergarten with. And I knew that if I stayed there, my opportunity was small. But if I went to the Bay Area, my opportunity would be larger. So that's one of many decisions I made that just moved me from low odds to better odds over time.
A lot of the story is his, but it's also a kind of map or cartography about how to fail at almost everything and still win big. Kind of the story of my life, Scott Adams puts it. Opportunity for you to talk with the creator of Dilbert and to talk about some of the issues we've raised here. We welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join us again. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. We're talking again with Scott Adams, creator of Dilbert, his new book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Dilbert creator and Bay Area resident and author Scott Adams. His new book is called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. And we do welcome your involvement in the conversation or anything you'd like to bring to the program in the way of questions or comments. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. Interesting, certainly, to hear from some Dilbert fans or maybe some of you who have been influenced by this highly influential comic strip, which is now syndicated. How many newspapers are you in, Scott?
Well, you say about 2,000 newspapers worldwide.
That's quite something. In fact, let me begin with a caller here. Neil, good morning.
Yeah, I'd like to find out what happened to that TV series that was based on Dilbert that only lasted about a year, if memory serves. Did you have any input on that at all?
Yeah, that it did last two half seasons back-to-back, so it was about a year, you're right. I was a co-executive producer. It was on the UPN network, and we didn't have much of a budget. We did the best we could. But what's strange with animation is that unlike a live TV where you can adjust things that aren't working fairly quickly, it takes months and months to animate something. So by the time we knew what worked on the first season, we were already in trouble for the second season, even though the quality of the second season was way better than the first. We lost our time slot due to a Dilbert miscommunication in management, as it turns out, which was funny. And then UPN decided that they were going to rebrand themselves as sort of a African-American network, and we were kind of an odd duck there.
Neil, thank you for the question. Actually, let me get back to your book with another question. Health is emphasized a great deal, as you did in terms of happiness and all, but energy, you keep coming back to personal energy.
Yeah, I decided that, and again, this is another simplification, that the things that give you energy, just physical energy, mental energy, they tend to be the right things. In other words, if the thing you're doing is going to result in you having more energy, whether it's exercise or fitness or anything else, you're probably doing the right thing. So, for example, one of the things I do to just always keep my energy high is I like to have at least one project going on that has the potential to change the world in some way. And this book is an example. So I think most people who follow Dilbert have figured out that I have enough money already. There's no money I'll ever make from now on that I'll personally spend. I have enough for me. So this book was, how do you make the world a better place? And it's weird that there's no book on success as a system, as a process. You know, there are lots of things said about success. And of course, school is teaching you skills that will help you be successful. But nobody takes it as almost a chess game. You know, what do you do that will give you the best chances of success? So I thought maybe if I write that book and maybe if it catches on, there are people out there who are like me, who are starting cold, didn't have mentors, didn't have anybody to help them, who can at least get a first step, you know, a sort of a template for success that will give them a little leg up.
We've got another call, and that's you, Patricia. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to make a comment about the equation of that creates happiness of health plus freedom. And I just felt that it misses the perspective that there are many people who are not healthy in the general term that most of us would consider healthy. For instance, I have a son who's in a wheelchair. He's never walked, and he never will. But I know that he's happy. And I know he'll have, and he has had, low days or disappointing or why me days. But the rest of us tend to have those days as well. And I see him as a very, very happy 10-year-old. And moving forward in his life, I see him as a very happy adult. He brings a tremendous amount of joy to those around him. So I just wanted to add that perspective of health that perhaps may be defined a little too narrowly.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say that people who have different abilities, you know, somebody can walk, somebody can see, somebody can hear, somebody can't. I don't think any of that is directly related to the happiness. The health I'm talking about is, you know, if your son has a flu, he's probably not too happy. So if he feels good, then that's sufficient. That's a good baseline for happiness.
And thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to some of the website and email responses. A listener writes, I no longer use a to-do list, but rather a progress list, because if I have a list of things to merely do without any connection to a goal, I often don't remember their importance and then don't do them.
I can relate to the problem with to-do lists. What I find is every time I write down my to-do list, the writing of it takes so long, and the list is so long that I won't review it. So I'll think to myself, that took a long time, and now I have a big list I'm not reviewing because there's just too many things on it. So, yeah, to-do lists, I'm in favor of them, but I wish I could figure out a way to make them, you know, 10 elements instead of 25 things I got to do.
Another listener writes on the website, I believe American culture is a mistake-phobic and failure-phobic but to a large extent the flip side of that, namely an obsession with winning and money accumulation, has condemned us to live in a moral vacuum in which we collectively lament living in a society where the power of money has corrupted our political system, trivialized our holidays, and has led to the outsourcing of jobs. And yet these are direct consequences of morality-free pursuit of money and success.
I'd like to read that guy's book. He sounds like he's got something to say. That sounds pretty interesting.
Wants to make an impact on the world just with a website comment, and you can. Another listener writes, which is safer, posting a cubicle wall full of Dilbert's often funny and valid complaints about modern business, or one small sign saying, I think that we who work here could work together to create better working conditions for ourselves?
Well, I've heard a lot of people getting in trouble for putting Dilbert comics on their wall. One fellow was famously fired from his job and made national news. I helped him get another job, as it turns out. I blogged, is there anybody else who wants to hire this fellow? And apparently he did get a job through that.
Were you in our green room, by the way, before you came in here?
I wasn't. There was something going on in there.
Well, oh, but we should usher you over there when the program is over, because some cartoonists have put cartoons on the wall. Certainly be privileged to have you among them. But it all started writing on the wall in that green room with Joan Baez doing a cartoon. It's actually a pretty good cartoon. How Gerald writes, how well will Mr. Adams' prescriptions work for the vast majority who will almost by definition not wind up at the top? Can one fail repeatedly, win moderately, fail again, and et cetera, and still have sufficient means by which to live decently and, of course, afford cartoon books or online subscriptions?
Well, first of all, I use myself as the poster case of how average talents can sum up to something if you play a smart. So if you look at my drawing ability, I've likened to an inebriated howler monkey. It's sort of a sixth grade level of drawing. I never took a writing class in school. I took a two-day business writing class, and that was it. I'm usually not even the funniest person in the room if I have a party at my own house. And my knowledge of business, probably better than average, but not great.
Hey, you worked in a bank for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I've got an MBA, so I'm steeped in it. But when you put all these fairly average or just okay talents together, they create the Dilbert Empire. But a big part of that is that I had to try a number of things until I found out, I guess by accident you could say, or luck, that these particular talents worked well together.
Speaking of the Dilbert Empire, could you talk about the Dilbert Ultimate House, the Duh? I mean, that was for the Adams family, so to speak, if you'll forgive my phrasing it as such.
Yeah, so years ago I solicited comments from my readers to tell me what they would like to see in an Ultimate House, because most houses are built by the developer or they're built by someone who is just building their own house and they don't know exactly what are the cool things you could put in a house. So I got lots of suggestions. Many of them became part of my current house that I did get to build a few years ago. So, for example, my house has a cat's bathroom. Instead of putting the cat box in your guest bathroom that smells it up, I have just a little closet-sized area off the laundry room that was built just for the cat. It's a huge advantage. One of the suggestions from the Dilbert Ultimate House was a Christmas tree closet just off the living room, where you could have a fully decorated artificial tree on rollers, and then you open the tall door and just roll it into the living room when it's December. And I actually built that closet, but then my wife at the time looked at it and said, you know, we've got these high ceilings and our tree needs to be really big for the living room, and it's not going to fit in that closet. So I did not plan well, but I had the best intentions of having a Christmas tree closet.
Bring another caller on here. Peter, join us. You're on, Peter. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, and good morning, Michael. I really admire your guest's sense of humor and the call. I don't read the comics that often, but when I do, I really enjoy Dilbert. And I really admire your desire to help others that you've talked about a little bit. But I want to push back a little bit of, on your statement that you wanted them dead, the people who had the attitude against euthanasia, you wanted them dead because they're making the world a worse place. You know, frankly, that's a good statement for a comic character like Dilbert. But if you say it as a sincere individual, it's really belying a sense of discouragement, it seems to me, and perhaps an unconscious, I don't know if it's unconscious, ill will. And don't you really want to say, I want to engage them in public debate with sufficient force? I want to find a way to somehow change their minds? I mean, isn't that a healthier, less violent? What about Kant's categorical imperative, where if everyone in the world would do, you know, what you were going to do, what would happen? Well, we'd all be dead quick, right?
No, actually, nobody would be dead if you did what I said, because I was very clear in that I'm not recommending it or planning it. So the actual killing of people I'm completely against, or whether it's me doing the killing or anybody else. What I was expressing was an emotion. And the emotion—
And a wish.
Right. But that was part of the emotion. And it was also a moral statement. Is it immoral if, for example, you see a terrorist running toward your building with a exploding vest, and you've got a gun, and you can put a hole in his forehead and stop the bomb from killing everybody? Is that immoral to wish that you could? To wish that you could stop the horror? You've got tens of millions of just people in the United States who are going to be tortured to death, essentially by their government, because the government won't allow the doctor and the families to make a choice that they might choose otherwise. So if you're saying that this particular case is like, oh, I don't want my taxes raised, I think you're missing the point that tens of millions of people are literally being tortured the last year of their life. So if that's not a big deal to you, I don't know what is.
You want to respond, Peter?
That was a very eloquent way of stating it without that, I don't know, edge. And perhaps I misunderstood your edge. But, when you restate it that way, and that you're really wanting to reach out to the people who have the other opinion and say, out of love and compassion, and salute. But I'm glad we've had this discussion.
Okay, thank you.
And by the way, I would add, as I said before, that I've yet to meet anybody who has an opinion on the opposite side of me. I've never met anyone who wants the government to make those decisions for them. I think that it's a mistake to think they're even out there.
What about religious people who are opposed to euthanasia? A lot of people, for example, who are pro-life are also, for Catholic religious purposes or whatever, opposed to taking a life with euthanasia. In fact, often more consistency there than there is between those who are pro-life and want to allow euthanasia.
I absolutely respect anyone who wants to make that choice for themselves. If they want to suffer because they feel that their life is valuable, that God wants them to live, whatever the reasons, I have complete respect for that view. What I don't have is someone else torturing my parents to death because they believe in magic. Okay? That doesn't work for me. And I've never met anyone who has the opposite view, that I should would you want your parents tortured for my belief in something you don't believe in?
Talking again with Scott Adams, and his book is How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win, and Elizabeth tweets, hey, Scott Adams, would you recommend your book in the hardcover format or ebook?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I'm qualified to answer that. It's personal preference.
And Bob writes, using the very occasional person who finally succeeds big after several failures as a role model is like the religious people who hold up the very occasional coincidental answer to prayer as a role model. It's simply unrealistic and basically counterproductive.
I think there's a 100% chance you're right in the sense that it's unlikely anybody's going to follow my book, read the book, and then become a famous cartoonist. But if you take the number of, let's say, engineers who are unemployed, it's a pretty low number. So engineers are people who went to school. They moved from a place of low odds to a place of good odds. They probably moved to a place that has the right jobs. So they just played the chess game right. And that's kind of what I'm saying. So even if that engineer worked for a startup that didn't work, a second startup that didn't work, well, what you find is that your odds of being on that your first startup works is very low. Your odds that your second startup works is much better, because you've learned something in the process. You've met a lot of people. You've got some skills. So everybody can move from lower odds to higher odds. But you're right. Not everybody's going to become the Dilbert cartoonist.
Here's Alan who asks on our Facebook page, has Scott written any positive motivational cartoons on his success with affirmations? Does he have any plans for motivational speaking?
I have not done any comics on the topic of affirmations. I try to keep the comic just fun, not so much motivational. I do give speeches now and then. I'm just starting to do that. I couldn't do it for a while because I couldn't speak for 3.5 years. But I'm just starting to do that now, yes.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's John in Livermore. John, you're on.
Yes, thank you very much. Mr. Adams, I love your cartoons, but one of the best things that you've ever done, I think, are the occasional columns in the Wall Street Journal. And the one you did about how you organized dorm living and things like that, I mean, that's just fantastic about a life lesson. So can you say a little more about that?
I'm sorry, I missed the topic.
Wall Street Journal columns that you wrote.
Right. What was the specific column you wanted me to talk about?
Well, about how you organized your dorm living arrangement, and then you took management control and so on. I mean, that's just great.
I think you're talking about the story about in my college days where my buddies and I decided we should be running the dormitory instead of the resident assistants. And we put together a proposal, and the college bought off on it, and we got ourselves single rooms, and we got paid, and we were working a number of jobs on the side, so... doesn't work so well as a quick story in the radio, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And it's probably available online. Wall Street Journal columns are. And Kenneth writes, how long does it take to create a typical Dilbert strip, and how far ahead do you stay, and how often do you run out of funny ideas?
It's funny that he put the three most common questions I've ever been asked in one
question. I assume that might be the case, yeah.
These days, when I use the Wacom to draw, I can do a daily comic in about 2 hours. So it takes about an hour to think it up, to rough it out, and then maybe another hour at some other part of the day to finish it. A Sunday comic will take me all day because there are more panels and I've got to color it and that sort of thing.
I wonder what you think about this comment from a listener named Vineet, who writes on Facebook, if you spin it right, you can never fail.
Well, that's the corporate way. You don't say you failed. You just slightly adjust.
It's the Madison Avenue political way too, right?
You slightly adjust your target to say that's what you're shooting at all along.
We got another caller on here, and that's Debbie. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, hi, Scott. I want to know if you have any plans on bringing back Ray Mabert. One of the funniest things I have ever read in my entire life.
Yeah, so Ray Mabert was a fake person. He was me, actually, wearing a disguise. The San Jose Mercury News sent a writer out to do a story with me, in which I dressed as a fake consultant and went to Logitech company here in the Bay Area. Their CEO was in on the joke, but his senior management was collected in a room, and I was the consultant that the CEO allegedly brought in to teach them how to make a better mission statement. But my hidden agenda was to make them come up with the worst mission statement ever written, something long and rambling and completely useless. And so after an hour, I did guide them toward the worst possible mission statement. And then to kind of cap it off, I asked for a volunteer to put it to music because I argued that people will remember things better if it's put to music. So I actually got a volunteer to put it to music. And that was the point I took off my fake mustache and fake wig and told them who I was.
You must also get asked often how much you're Dilbert or how much Dilbert is you. And how do you answer that question?
Well, Dilbert is a lot of me, so he's certainly the socially awkward part of me. He had the same job I had, roughly. I wasn't a qualified engineer like he is. And I spread my personality across the several characters. So the lazy part of me is in Wally, and the evil part of me is in Dogbert, and the angry part of me is in Alice.
And is it also fair to say that you were influenced by what now would be standard traditional cartoonists, I mean, like Charles Schulz, for example?
Charles Schulz was my biggest influence, to the point where it literally was the reason I was interested in learning to read. You know, when I was 5, 6 years old, I would see these Dilbert books at my grandmother's house, and I wanted to read them.
Dilbert books?
I'm sorry. Peanuts books. And I wanted to read them. And so that was a good enough reason to learn to read when you're that age.
But also, Peanuts had a kind of wisdom. And I think what you're doing in this book and what you've done in a lot of your cartooning is wanting to impart wisdom, isn't it?
Well, with the comic, I'm not shooting for wisdom. I'm shooting for 30 seconds of, you know, I'm glad I read that. And in a perfect world, I'm glad I forwarded that to somebody, or I'm glad I showed it to my boss to show him that his plan is ridiculous. So if it's got a little usefulness, that's great. But if they just people just find it amusing, that's all I'm shooting for.
So what cartoonists other than Schultz do you admire most?
I like Pearls Before Swine. That's a big favorite. Get Fuzzy is good. In the online world, webcomics, I like XKCD. But frankly, I stay away from reading comics.
You don't read graphic fiction, for example?
I stay away from comics in general just because I don't want to be influenced.
So you're influenced by what then? Just life itself?
Yeah. So my job is essentially pattern recognition and simplification, you know, the two things I do. So I'm looking for something in life that isn't just a, oh my God, I can't believe that happened, but it has to be an, oh my God, I can't believe that happened, and that's the fifth time that's happened. That's the fifth time I've seen it, or X times. Then I know I have something. But it usually is complicated. It can't fit in a comic strip, so then I do the simplification to make it fit.
But you're living, kind of removed from being the anthropological observer of life to a great extent, aren't you?
Well, there's always that risk, you know, when you move to the nice neighborhood and you're no longer working in the cubicle. But luckily, I have vast numbers of readers who are sending me ideas, and you don't really forget what it was like to be in a cubicle. It's kind of like going to prison. You know, you don't get out of prison and say, you know, I've been out for a day and I already can't remember what that cell was like. You know, there's some things that are burned in your mind. But I also work on a number of side ventures. Some of the ones you mentioned, the failures, the restaurants. I had a food company making a vegetarian burrito for a while. And right now I'm in the process of launching a startup called CalendarTree.com. It's for helping people with teams and groups schedule. So I'm always involved in business. So I'm never out of that world.
You said before that you don't consider yourself that great a cartoonist in terms of the art or being able to create cartoons that are, in the first tier of cartoons perhaps, or something along those lines. Do you need to be really a good artist to be a cartoonist? Or can you be kind of almost a fundamental drawing type of person?
Well, I think there are two kinds of cartoonists. There are art-centric ones where the value of the comic is really the drawing, and then the writing is kind of nice. Mine and Doonesbury in the old days and Kathy when Kathy was running, those were all writer comics. So it was all about the writing and the drawing was secondary. So I think it works both ways, apparently.
You also have a lot of very dedicated fans, and I wonder about just your relationship with people who are not only giving you ideas, but people who are commenting on your work or who are essentially responding and reacting to your work.
What about them? Just
I mean, you have ongoing correspondence, for example?
Oh, yeah. So either through the Dilbert Facebook page, I'm on LinkedIn.
Social networks type stuff?
Yeah. I print my email addresses in the strip. People make comments on Dilbert.com, and they email me directly all the time. So I'm continually jacked into the public.
And since you made the analogy between, I don't know if it was jail or prison, and being in a cubicle, what did you do to get through that time?
You know, it turns out that I can put up with a lot, I've learned. So the good news for me is that I came from such a humble upbringing. You know, meaning a...
You grew up where?
In upstate New York. And so by the time I'd moved to college and I was sharing this little square room that's actually smaller than the size of my bathroom is now, and two people were in it, that felt like I'd gone to heaven. Like I was living the good life then. So college just seemed like luxury to me. So when I, you know...
And college was where in New York too?
Hartwick College in Oneonta, New York. Mm-hmm. And when I got out to the real world, let's say, of California, and by the time I got a job and had my own cubicle, to me, you know, in the early days, it felt like luxury. After a while, it starts wearing you down. You can't sit in a little gray box for too long without having it steal part of your soul. But I probably was in better shape than most people because I was coming from a lower base.
Would you have maybe a craziest cubicle story?
I will tell you that the cubicle mate on the other side of my cubicle was later convicted for murdering his friend, and he wrote a book about it. You Got Nothing Coming by Jimmy Lerner. It was a pretty good book. And he was in marketing. And you know how they always say, you know, I didn't see it coming. I can't believe that guy killed the guy. I'm not so sure I would have said that in this case.
You know, he wasn't, because?
Well, he was in marketing after all. And, you know, he would come in and check in and then go back to his home that was nearby and hang out for the rest of the day. So I wasn't too surprised.
Well, thank you for spending this time with us. Good to have you on Forum, and good luck with the book. The book, again, by Scott Adams, is How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that you can always continue conversations by going to our website or our Facebook page. The website is kqed.org/forum. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.